There is much to be said for this interpretation, which has the virtue of linking his earlier obsessions with English political corruption to his equally obsessive hatred of Hamilton's financial program and the Hamiltonian vision of a proactive national government, which Jefferson purportedly regarded as the latter-day apparition of a political dragon he thought he had slain in 1776. This way of understanding Jefferson's hyperbolic rhetoric in the 1790s as a recurrence of the country party fears of the American Revolution also has the virtue of undercutting criticism of his apparent extremism in the political crusade against Hamilton. For if one is going to question Jefferson's sanity in the 1790s, does that not then cast aspersions on his equivalently polemical assaults on George III during the most gloriously patriotic moment in American history? Jefferson was not, let us be clear and emphatic on this point, a mentally unstable person or a man with latent paranoid tendencies. The conspiratorial character of his political thinking in the 1790s, as all scholars of the Whig ideology have reminded us, was a common feature of the political literature of the time, and substantial traces of the same feverish mentality can be found in the private correspondence of the entire political leadership, including Adams, Madison, and Hamilton. Only Washington seems to have remained immune, but then he was immune to everything. Unless one is prepared to make sweeping psychiatric charges against the vanguard members of the entire revolutionary generation, which is generally credited with being the most intellectually gifted group of political leaders in American history, then psychiatric appraisals of Jefferson himself should be recognized as both misleading and unfair. The leading scholar of the revolutionary era has also reminded us that conspiracy theories not only were prevalent ways of thinking and talking about political events by mainstream as well as marginal figures, but also provided a secular way of explaining baffling social changes in terms that improved upon previous resorts to fate, providence, or God's will. That said, Jefferson's simplistic and highly moralistic rendering of what the Federalists, and especially the Hamiltonians, were doing merits a moment of meditation, if for no other reason than that the country party interpretation does not do full justice to the way Jefferson's mind actually worked. Perhaps the best way to put it is that because he began with a purer and more intensely idealistic conception of the levels of individual freedom possible in this world, especially after the final vestiges of kingly and clerical power had been blown away, Jefferson harbored a more acute sensitivity toward the explicit exercise of government power than any other member of the revolutionary generation. Because the primary colors of his political imagination were black and white, there were no shaded hues, no middle-range way stations where his apprehensions about the oppressive effects of political power could rest more comfortably once threats to his utopian goals materialized. Hamilton's plan for a proactive federal government empowered to shape markets and set both the financial and political agendas were certainly not monarchical in character. If anything, they were more a precocious precursor of 20th-century New Deal values than an archaic attempt to resuscitate the arbitrary authority of medieval kings and courts. But in Jefferson's mind, these distinctions made no appreciable difference. Energetic governmental power of any sort was intolerable because it originated outside the individual. It therefore violated his romantic ideal of personal autonomy. George III's edicts and Parliament's taxation policies, it is true, elicited the same fears back in the 1760s and 1770s, but Hamilton did not just conjure up bad memories of English oppression. He directly threatened the primal core of Jefferson's wistful world. In addition, Jefferson's emerging sense of himself as the leader of the country party assumed a distinctively Jeffersonian flavor that was different from the original English meaning of the term, for the rather obvious reason that country meant different things for him than for a resident of Walpolean England. When he was asked to describe the social composition of the two parties, for example, his list of anti-republicans consisted of former loyalists and Tories, American merchants trading with England, stock speculators and banking officials, federal employees and other office seekers, and, an all-purpose psychological category, nervous persons whose languid fibers have more analogy with a passive than active state of things. The list of Republicans, on the other hand, was much shorter, but included the vast majority of American voters. It was comprised of the entire body of landholders throughout the United States, as well as the body of laborers not being landholders, whether in husbanding or the arts. Jefferson estimated that the latter is to the aggregate of the former party probably as 500-1. Here one gets an early whiff of the distinctively Democratic odor with which Jefferson's name would eventually be associated. In the traditional Whig formulation, the Country Party was an elite group of landowners who opposed the policies of the Court Party, and the two competing elites offered different prescriptions for what was in the best interest of the public. But Jefferson had come to see himself as the leader of a popular majority, doing political battle against an elite minority. This was a new way of thinking about politics in the late 18th century. True, it drew upon traditional notions of conspiracy long associated with Whig ideology. The anti-Republican supporters of Hamilton's policies, for example, though a mere minority, enjoyed circumstances which give them an appearance of strength and numbers. Their chief advantage, Jefferson thought, was that they all live in cities, together, and can act in a body readily and at all times, whereas his constituency was dispersed over a great extent of country and have little means of intercommunication with each other. The chief disadvantage facing the Country Party, in other words, was that it lived in the country. But the novel feature of Jefferson's formulation of American political life was that it was essentially a matter of numbers. He regarded himself as the spokesman for a latent majority of Americans who, if they could ever be mobilized, would assume their rightful place as true heirs to the spirit of 76. And instead of talking about them as the public, he began in the 1790s to speak in the more democratic idiom of the people. These were prophetic tendencies. Dreams and deaths. Very few letters went out from Monticello during Jefferson's first year of retirement, and the ones that did conveyed the impression that the former Secretary of State had successfully completed the long-awaited odyssey from the purgatory of politics to his own pastoral paradise. He wrote to Washington not as the president, but as a fellow farmer, recalling that both men were familiar with a scheme to manufacture an essence of dung, one pint of which could manure an acre, and that if any ingenious inventor could render it portable, Jefferson was now prepared to purchase a huge supply. To James Monroe, who was serving as the American minister in Paris, he apologized for the infrequency of his letters, blaming the long silence on that sort of procrastination which so often takes place when no circumstance fixes a business to a particular time. When word reached him that his old Parisian infatuation, Maria Causeway, had left her husband, abandoned her young child, and sequestered herself in an Italian convent, he wrote her in the old sentimental style of times past. "I regret the distance which separates us and will not permit myself to believe that we are no more to meet till you meet me where time and distance are nothing." But she was wrong to bury herself in a cloistered room where the sun is ever excluded, the balmy breeze never felt. He had chosen the opposite direction for himself, spending his days out of doors like a real farmer, measuring fields, following my plows, helping the haymakers, and never knowing a day which has not done something for futurity. He assured his friends that his serenity, like a field of planted flowers, had germinated and was now bursting out inside his soul. It was the lifelong Jeffersonian domestic ideal, now at midlife and in the proper rural context, to be living like an antediluvian patriarch among my children and grandchildren and tilling my soil. Certain features in this idyllic scene, especially the family dimension, apparently did come together for Jefferson at least momentarily in the mid-1790s. Patsy, now a full-grown woman whom Jefferson addressed as Martha, had married Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. in 1790, soon after her return from France. When she was a young girl studying in Paris, Jefferson had worried out loud about the chances that in marriage she will draw a blockhead. But Randolph put those worries to rest. A Virginia gentleman of the finest pedigree, Randolph had been educated in Edinburgh and, in fact, modeled himself after his new father-in-law. Tall, sinewy like Jefferson, but with black hair and a dark complexion, he was a splendid horseman, one of the few Virginians who could outride Jefferson. As a young man, he possessed the dashing charm and beguiling eccentricities associated with other male members of the Randolph clan, like saluting nonchalantly as his horse cleared a formidable fence. By 1795, he and Martha had already produced 2 grandchildren for Jefferson. 9 more were on the way. In addition to substantial holdings at Verina on the James River below Richmond, in 1792 Randolph purchased Edge Hill, a 1,500-acre estate only 2 miles from Monticello, so he and Martha could be regular presences in Jefferson's domestic circle and full-fledged residents of Monticello throughout the summers. In June of 1796, a visiting French nobleman, the Duc de la Rochefoucauld-Liancourt, who was one of the aristocratic refugees from the current bloodbath in France, described Jefferson supervising his wheat harvest in the fields with Randolph alongside him, commenting that from the affection he, Jefferson, bears him, Randolph seems to be his son rather than his son-in-law. La Rochefoucauld-Liancourt then went on to describe the other member of Jefferson's family unit at Monticello, the former Polly, now old enough to turn heads among all the eligible bachelors of Albemarle County, and be referred to by her proper name. Miss Maria constantly resides with her father, but as she is 17 years old and is remarkably handsome, she will doubtless soon find that there are duties which it is still sweeter to perform than those of a daughter. A year later, Maria fulfilled this prediction by becoming engaged to John Wales Epps, whom Jefferson described as just the young man he would have chosen for his stunningly beautiful daughter. "If I had had the whole earth free to have chosen a partner for her," Jefferson then explained to Martha, how Maria's looming marriage provided the final ingredient for his long-standing plan of domestic harmony. "I now see our fireside formed in a group. No one member has a fiber in their composition which can ever produce any jarring or jealousies among us. No irregular passions, no dangerous bias, which may render problematic the future fortunes and happiness of our descendants. We are quieted as to their condition for at least one generation more." Like many of Jefferson's fondest and most heartfelt visions, this one proved too good to be true. Despite her father's wedding gift of 800 acres within sight of Monticello, designed to keep her close, Maria preferred to live on her husband's family lands at Eppington, and like her mother, she died prematurely during childbirth in 1804. Meanwhile, Thomas Mann Randolph became afflicted with a mysterious nervous disorder soon after Jefferson took up residence as paterfamilias. Neither a tour through the cooler climate of New England nor several visits to the hot springs of Virginia produced the desired cure, leaving Jefferson himself to wonder what ailed his beloved son-in-law. Alcoholism became a problem in the ensuing years, and rumors began to circulate that young Randolph had inherited a streak of the eccentric behavior, enemies called it outright lunacy, that stalked the Randolph line. By 1802, he was confessing his feelings of inadequacy as a member of the Jefferson family, like something extraneous, fallen in by accident and destroying the homogeneity, the self-declared silly bird who could never feel at ease among the swans. Indeed, the only persevering portion of Jefferson's domestic dream was Martha, who devoted herself to her father and her children in the selfless fashion in which she had been reared, never talked about her husband's mounting emotional problems, in fact acknowledged in 1798 that her love for her husband had never really displaced the first and best of nature, meaning her feelings for her father. Whether this rather extreme version of daughterly affection had something to do with Thomas Mann Randolph's slide into despair and eventual destitution is not clear. What is clear is that despite what must have been many idyllic moments soon after Jefferson's retirement, expectations of an abiding form of domestic bliss on his mountaintop were forced to adjust themselves to the emotional rivalries that had infiltrated his domestic circle. Jefferson's attitude toward whatever psychological conflicts were steadily eroding these dreams was self-conscious silence. When Maria once mentioned the dilemma posed by the persistent alcoholism of a distant relative, Jefferson advised her to avoid discussing the subject. "What is the use of rectifying him if the thing be unimportant?" he asked rhetorically. "And if important, let it pass for the present. It is wonderful how many persons are rendered unhappy by inattention to these little rules of prudence." Such acts of prudent obliviousness also had the decided advantage of sustaining the imaginary ideal. In the Jeffersonian family code, one not only kept secrets from outsiders, one kept secrets from oneself. Much like his domestic ideal, Jefferson's agrarian ideal was utterly sincere, an honest expression of how he wished to see himself, but set so far from the messy and mundane realities of plantation life in post-revolutionary Virginia that collisions between inferior preferences and exterior limitations were unavoidable, in the end, tragically so. One of his most famous utterances, trailing only his classic statement on human rights in the Declaration of Independence, as an eloquent contribution to American prose history, is the following passage from Notes on Virginia. "Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, if ever he had a chosen people, whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit of genuine virtue. It is the focus in which he keeps alive that sacred fire, which otherwise might escape from the face of the earth." As one modern-day scholar and farmer has observed, American agriculture has never quite recovered from this resounding compliment. Indeed, the entire history of farming in 19th and 20th century America can be written as a clash between the mythical status of the Jeffersonian tiller of the soil and the harsh realities of capricious weather and equally capricious markets. That long and often paradoxical story, it turns out, actually had its origins in the experience of Jefferson himself. Reality came at Jefferson in several overlapping waves, but the most elemental fact was that he was not an independent yeoman farmer, but an indebted Virginia planter. By the time of his retirement as Secretary of State, he owed about £4,500 to English creditors in Bristol and another £2,000 to a Glasgow firm. The bulk of this debt had been incurred in the 1770s, when he inherited the burdened estate of his father-in-law, John Wales. But what he called his thraldom of debt had been further complicated by the wartime inflation that rendered his efforts at payment valueless, by the declining productivity of his lands during his long absences from Monticello from 1784 to 1794, as well as by his apparently constitutional inability to live within a budget or deny himself books, fine furnishings, expensive wines, or other essentials of the good life. During the latter phase of his ministry in France, he had become increasingly aware of the growing gap between his income and his expenses, indeed almost obsessively aware that the interest on his debts was compounding at a faster rate than his payments on the principal. When he left public office in 1794, while he had sounded the familiar Ciceronian note about his craving for bucolic simplicity, he apprised Washington, more practically, that he had retired in order to rescue himself from debt and his lands from the ravages of overseers, which has brought on them a degree of degradation far beyond what I had expected. His financial predicament was serious. Comparisons in modern-day terms are notoriously tricky to calculate, but can conservatively be estimated in the range of several $100,000. But they were also fairly typical for the planter class of post-revolutionary Virginia. In 1790, residents of the Old Dominion owed £2.3 million to English and Scottish creditors, and the most prominent families of Virginia were also the most prominent names on the list of more than 30,000 delinquent debtors kept by British merchants. Jefferson was profoundly aware of the massive indebtedness afflicting his friends and neighbors, once even explaining to a French admirer that the debts of Virginia's planters were hereditary from father to son for so many generations, so that the planters were a species of property annexed to certain mercantile houses in London. He said pretty much the same thing to his younger daughter. "The unprofitable condition of Virginia estates, in general, leaves it next to impossible for the holder of one to avoid ruin. And this condition will continue until some change takes place in the mode of working them, In the meantime, nothing can save us and our children from beggary but a determination to get a year beforehand, and restrain ourselves vigorously to the clear profits of the last. If a debt is once contracted by a farmer, it is never paid but by a sale of the estate. Given his own indulged habits of consumption and the eventual fate of his beloved Monticello, this proved to be a highly ironic statement. But in the middle years of the 1790s, he could neither foresee the future nor appreciate irony. What he could do, or at least try mightily to do, was make his lands more productive and pay off his debts. Farming, then, meant making money. His landed assets were impressive, but deceptively so. Jefferson owned nearly 11,000 acres, but equally divided between estates surrounding Monticello in Albemarle County and western lands concentrated in Bedford County, about 90 miles away. He had sold off additional acreage lying along the James River to the southeast in Goochland and Cumberland counties, in part to pay off debts and in part to consolidate his holdings. Despite the sale, Jefferson remained one of the largest landowners in the state. One of the reasons he found it difficult to accept the full implications of his indebtedness was that he thought of wealth like an old-style Virginia aristocrat, in terms of land rather than money or more liquid forms of capital. For Jefferson, land was the best measure of a man's worth, and, as he put it, that of which I am the most tenacious. Despite the haunting presence of his English and Scottish creditors, he thought of himself as a landed and therefore a wealthy man. He expected the land to rescue him from those creditors once he took personal charge of managing its cultivation. His plan was clear. He would abandon tobacco as his chief cash crop in favor of wheat. In his Notes on Virginia, he had described tobacco growing as a culture productive of infinite wretchedness, in part because the noxious weed served no earthly purpose other than to feed a nasty habit, but also because the plant possessed an almost unique capacity to kill the land, because his own lands were, as he put it, as yet reclaimed from the barbarous state in which the slovenly business of tobacco making had left them. He would insist upon the adoption of a 7-step long-term plan of crop rotation designed to permit the soil to recover its former fertility. Throughout the spring and summer of 1794, Jefferson focused the bulk of his considerable energies on the details of his 7-step rotation plan, giving it all the concentrated attention he had previously given to American domestic politics or foreign policy. At least at the theoretical level, which was where Jefferson always did his most impressive thinking, his plan had much to recommend it. Wheat was becoming the crop of choice among Virginia's more progressive planters. Washington had helped lead the way here because it did less damage to the soil and enjoyed several market advantages over tobacco, the chief ones being that people needed to eat more than they needed to smoke, and that the ongoing war between England and France presented a golden opportunity to capture the European markets for foodstuffs. The elaborateness of his 7-step rotation program meant that it would take a long time, at least 7 years, before his fields were fully ready for extensive wheat cultivation, but that seemed a price worth paying to do the job right. The plan provides additional evidence that Jefferson saw himself as remaining at Monticello for the duration. He was planning for the long haul. Of all the reasons why the plan failed, and after some initial success it did fail in just about every possible way, perhaps the main culprit was the bane of all farmers: bad weather and bad luck. Droughts and early frosts damaged Jefferson's wheat crop 3 years in succession. Heavy rains soaked the grain while it was being shipped by barge downriver. Later on, the dreaded Hessian fly settled over his fields at regular intervals, consuming whatever had managed to survive the capricious elements. One cannot read through his farm book, where Jefferson recorded his seasonal encounters, with the vagaries of the weather and the countless impediments to his best-laid plans, without concluding that however fortunate he was, a public figure, he was an extremely unlucky farmer. Beyond bad luck, however, there were two elemental reasons why Jefferson's plantations were not really capable of producing cash crops at a level sufficient to generate substantial profits. First, he simply did not have enough land under cultivation. When one conjures up the image of an 11,000-acre plantation, it is difficult not to be influenced by the popular iconography of the huge agrarian factories of the antebellum South, with their vast fields and gangs of slave laborers organized in quasi-military units. But Jefferson's lands, and indeed most of Virginia's plantations in the 18th century, did not look or function at all like that. Instead of one large tract stretching out to the horizon, Jefferson owned seven separate and disparate farms, Monticello and Shadwell in Albemarle County, and Poplar Forest, Tufton, Bear Lake, Lego, and Tomahawk in Bedford. Moreover, only about 1,000 acres of his total holdings were under cultivation. The rest was forest. In effect, Jefferson did not oversee a unified plantation in the familiar sense of the term so much as a series of modest-sized farms. Taken together, these scattered agrarian communities were capable of producing enough corn, oats, potatoes, rye, peas, barley, and flax to support themselves and, in good years, to show a small profit. That, in fact, is what they managed to do year in and year out. But the acreage under cultivation was too small, and the organization of the enterprise too decentralized to permit much more. Second, the land Jefferson owned lacked the nutrients and the corresponding fertility necessary to produce a bumper cash crop. Even if the weather and the fates had been kinder, they would have had a difficult time overcoming the geological realities. Jefferson liked to blame the poor quality of his soil on the exhausting effects of tobacco and the careless management of his lands by overseers during his absence in France and Philadelphia. This was true enough, but it failed to acknowledge the more elemental fact that his plantations were on the eastern slope of a mountain range. Aesthetically and visually, this location could claim few equals, commanding a spectacular view from Monticello east toward the tidewater. But though it looked down on some of the richest soil in Virginia, the very height that made the view so stunning also made the soil inferior for purposes of cultivation. If he had had access to 20th-century fertilizers and farming techniques, things might have been different. Modern farmers in the area earn their livings with livestock. So while Jefferson preferred to believe that his lands had been worn out, this meant that proper care by means of a meticulous crop rotation system could reclaim their fertility, the less palatable truth was that the soil lacked the basic nutrients essential for a flourishing plantation economy. The ground around Monticello, for example, was clay-based and therefore excellent for making bricks, but even as one admires the distinctive dark red hues of the mansion facade today, one is also looking at another underlying reason why Jefferson was not destined to be a successful farmer. Although Jefferson never fully grasped the intractability of the economic predicament, he had a sharp sense of the need to generate income, presumably to tide him over until his lands recovered their productivity, so he decided early on to establish a nail-making business on the grounds of Monticello. He described his reasoning in a letter to a French correspondent in the spring of 1795. "In returning home after an absence of 10 years, I found my farms so much deranged that I saw evidently that it was necessary for me to find some other resource in the meantime. I concluded at length to begin a manufacture of nails, which needs little or no capital, and I now employ 12 little boys from 10 to 16 years of age, overlooking all the details of their business myself and drawing from it profit on which I can get along till I can put my farms into a course of yielding profit." He joked about his new occupation as manufacturer and factory foreman, claiming that, "My new trade of nail-making is to me in this country what an additional title of nobility or the ensigns of a new order are in Europe." But he was deadly serious about supervising the operation personally and enforcing a rigid regimen for the teenage black slaves who constituted his labor force. Every morning except Sunday, he walked over to the nailery soon after dawn to weigh out the nail rod for each worker, then returned at dusk to weigh the nails each had made and calculate how much iron had been wasted by the most and least efficient workers. Isaac Jefferson recalled that his former master made it clear to all hands that the nailery was a personal priority and that special privileges would be accorded the best nail makers. He gave the boys in the nail factory 1 pound of meat a week. give them what worked the best, a suit of red or blue, encourage them mightily. Jefferson even added the naillery to his familiar refrain in the pastoral mode. I am so much immersed in farming and nail-making, he reported in the fall of 1794, that politics are entirely banished from my mind. He also immersed himself in the business side of nail-making, demanding cheaper prices from his nail-rod supplier in Philadelphia, noting increases in the price of iron, keeping track of retail sales of his product at local stores, and worrying when a deluge of British nails flooded the local market, with a view, as is said, of putting down my work. The fact that they were British nails meant that he took it personally. From a financial perspective, the naillery made perfect sense. In fact, in terms of his struggle to make his plantations profitable, the naillery was the one success story, earning almost $1,000 in a good year. But seen in the context of Jefferson's eloquent hymn to the bucolic beauties of the pastoral life, it was a massive incongruity. A historian with the ironic sensibility of, say, Henry Adams, could have a field day contemplating the symbolic significance of a small factory perched atop Monticello in the heart of Jefferson's agrarian utopia, perhaps concluding that it was America's original version of The Machine in the Garden, or a novelist with the temperament of Charles Dickens might have taken delight in comparing the regimen of Jefferson's naillery with the sweatshops and dawn-to-dusk drudgery of London's satanic mills. Jefferson himself, it should be noted, had no comparable sense of irony or contradiction. He felt no need to apologize for bringing industry to Monticello. There is no evidence that it ever occurred to him that his daily visits to the nail factory, with its blazing forges and sweating black boys arranged along an assembly line of hammers and anvils, offered a graphic preview of precisely the kind of industrial world he devoutly wished America to avoid, or at least to delay for as long as possible. At a more mundane level, Jefferson's dedication to the meticulous management of the naillery illustrates what compelled his fullest energies as master of Monticello. Both ex-slave Madison Hemmings and former overseer Edmund Bacon, though recalling a later time in his life, claimed that Jefferson showed but little taste or care for agricultural pursuits. It was his mechanics he seemed mostly to direct, and in their operations he took great interest. Though his first year of retirement in 1794-95 appears to have been an exception, his general rule was to pass little time in his fields, preferring to leave their cultivation to his overseers, except at harvest time. He spent no time at all behind a plow, and almost no time watching others perform the routine tasks of farming. What most fascinated him and commanded his fullest attention were new projects that demanded mechanical or artisanal skill of his laborers and that allowed him to design and superintend the entire operation. The naillery was the first of such projects, but it was followed by construction of a new threshing machine, plans for a flour mill, and an expensive canal in the Ravenna River. But the biggest project of all was Monticello itself. He had, in fact, been contemplating a major overhaul of his mansion ever since his return from France in 1789. From a financial point of view, the idea of renovating Monticello, unlike his plans for the naillery, made no sense at all. But when it came to the elegance and comfort of his personal living space, Jefferson's lifelong habit was to ignore cost altogether, often going so far as to make expensive architectural changes in houses or hotels where he was only a temporary resident. His much grander plans for Monticello followed naturally from two idealistic impulses that seized his imagination with all the force of his first principles. First, he needed more space, more than twice that of the original house, in order to accommodate his domestic dream of living out his life surrounded by his children and grandchildren. Second, his revised version of Monticello needed to embody the neoclassical principles of the Palladian style that his European travels had allowed him to study firsthand. The conjuncture of these two cravings had drastic implications, since the spatial expansion had to occur within severely constrained conceptions of symmetry and proportion dictated by the Palladian principles for beauty. The new structure could not just spread out like a series of boxcars, but neither could it rise vertically, since Palladian buildings must present at least the appearance of a one-story horizontal line, preferably capped by a dome. What this meant, in effect, was that the original house needed to be almost completely demolished and rebuilt from the cellar up. Brickmaking started soon after his return home in 1794, but throughout that year and the next, Jefferson focused most of his energies on his fields and the nailery. Some construction work must have begun right away, since Jefferson reported to George Wythe in October 1794 that he was now living in a brick kiln for my house, and its present state is nothing more. But a year and a half later, in March 1796, he informed William Branch Giles that he had just begun the demolition of my house, adding that Giles should not let this discourage you from calling on us if you wander this way in the summer, and joking that he could stay in one of the unfinished open-air rooms. An Irish traveler passing through in May of the same year described Monticello as in an unfinished state, but if carried to the plan laid out, it would be one of the most elegant private habitations in the United States. Visits by two Frenchmen provide us with the only other direct testimony about the physical condition of life on the mountaintop at this time. The Duc de la Rochefoucauld-Liancourt tended to overlook the clutter and, like a good Jeffersonian, described the promise, "His travels in Europe have supplied him with models. He has appropriated them to his design, and his new plan, which is already much advanced, will be accomplished before the end of next year." He was off by 12 or 26 years, depending on how one calculates completion. Count François de Volney, another refugee from the French Revolution who wished to visit, received a welcoming note from Jefferson that included more candid advice about the view that would greet him. "The noise, confusion, and discomfort of the scene will require all your philosophy and patience." Throughout the vast bulk of Jefferson's sequestration, it seems clear Monticello was a congested construction site, replete with broken bricks, roofless rooms, lumber piles, and, if some reports are to be believed, more than 100 workmen digging, tearing, and hammering away. The millions of 20th-century visitors to the mansion are the real beneficiaries of Jefferson's irrational decision to redesign and rebuild Monticello in the 1790s, though they would be mistaken to think the house in which Jefferson lived looked the way it does now. It was in some state of repair or improvement throughout Jefferson's lifetime. More to our purposes, from 1794 to 1797, Monticello was part ruin, part shell, and mostly still dream. Not only is it wrong to envision Jefferson's estates as an integrated agrarian enterprise along the lines of Tara and Gone with the Wind, not only is it misguided to imagine Jefferson walking behind a plow or spending much time supervising others walking behind a plow, but it is also misleading to think of him residing in a palatial home shaped by his distinctive tastes and filled with his favorite curiosities. Monticello was an excavation rather than a mansion at this stage. It was also his largest and most all-consuming project, the activity that soaked up his best energies and provided him with a sense of purpose. While his inspirational hymn to the virtuous farmer was unquestionably genuine, the truth was that farming bored him. Retirement to rural solitude did not mean tilling the soil, but digging it up to build something new and useful on it. Slavery. Almost all the work, whether in the fields, in the nailery, or at the construction site for Monticello itself, was done by slaves. The total slave population on Jefferson's several plantations was a fluctuating figure, oscillating above and below 200 and divided between Albemarle and Bedford counties at the ratio of roughly 3 to 2. Between 1784 and 1794, as Jefferson attempted to consolidate his landholdings and reduce his debt, he had disposed of 161 slaves by sale or outright gift. But natural increase had raised the slave population on all his estates to 167 by 1796, and that number was to grow gradually over the ensuing years. On his plantations in Albemarle County, It would seem safe to estimate that Jefferson was surrounded by about 100 slaves during his 3-year retirement. It is, on the other hand, by no means safe to estimate Jefferson's thoughts and feelings about what, in effect, constituted the overwhelming majority of residents at Monticello. Although Jefferson had made extended visits to Monticello during his years as Secretary of State, his duties in Paris and before then in Philadelphia and Williamsburg meant that he was mostly an absentee slave owner for the better part of 15 years. During that time, his views on the institution of slavery had fluctuated in much the same way as the size of his own slave population, oscillating between outright condemnation of slavery as incompatible with Republican values, and equally outright procrastination when pushed to offer practical remedies to end it. Of course, the gap between what ought to be and what the world allowed constituted the central dilemma of Jefferson's overall cast of mind on almost all political topics. But the problem of slavery exposed the gap more dramatically than any other issue. It also exposed his intellectual awkwardness in attempting to straddle what was, in fact, a moral chasm between what he knew to be right and what he could not do without. Even at the purely theoretical level, then, his thinking about slavery as a matter of public policy was deeply paradoxical and tinctured with personal considerations. The return to Monticello in 1794 and his apparently permanent encampment among those who labor for my happiness put an even sharper edge on the paradox by making the theoretical problem into a palpable, day-by-day set of personal interactions. If Jefferson had a discernible public position on slavery in the mid-1790s, it was that the subject should be allowed to retire gracefully from the field of political warfare, much as he was doing by retiring to Monticello. This represented a decided shift from his position as a younger man, when he had assumed a leadership role in pushing slavery into the agenda in the Virginia Assembly and the Federal Congress. His most famous formulations, it is true, were rhetorical, blaming the slave trade and the establishment of slavery itself on George III in the Declaration of Independence, denouncing slavery as a morally bankrupt institution that was doomed to extinction in Notes on Virginia. His most practical proposals, all of which came in the early 1780s, envisioned a program of gradual abolition that featured an end to the slave trade, the prohibition of slavery in all the Western territories, and the establishment of a fixed date, he suggested 1800, after which all newly born children of slaves would be emancipated. To repeat, up through this stage of his political career, he was a member of the vanguard that insisted on the incompatibility of slavery with the principles on which the American Republic was founded. Throughout this early phase of his life, it would have been unfair to accuse him of hypocrisy for owning slaves or to berate him for failing to provide moral leadership on America's most sensitive political subject. It would, in fact, have been much fairer to applaud his efforts, most of them admittedly futile, to inaugurate anti-slavery reform, and to wonder admiringly how this product of Virginia's planter class had managed to develop such liberal convictions. Dating the origins of a long silence is an inherently imprecise business, but it would seem that Jefferson's posture toward slavery began to shift in the mid to late 1780s during his ministry to France. This is ironic since during this time, he was telling his French audience misleadingly optimistic stories about the imminent demise of slavery in his native Virginia and playing the Parisian version of the American anti-slavery champion. But he was simultaneously beginning to back away from any leadership role in the American debate over slavery. I have long since given up the expectation of any early provision for the extinguishment of slavery among us, he wrote in 1805, going on to reiterate his belief that slavery was an anomaly in Republican America. But his abiding posture was that the current configuration of political forces blocked any meaningful reform at present, so that all one could realistically do was wait for the future to prepare public opinion for the inevitable. This more passive and fatalistic position, which he maintained for the remainder of his life, was the product of several different lines of thought that converged in his mind after 1785. It was, in fact, a more intellectually and psychologically complex view than it appears at first, and since it was the view he carried in his head to Monticello in 1794, its origins merit a moment of our attention. First, as we have seen, Jefferson's withdrawal from the anti-slavery vanguard followed directly upon publication of Notes on Virginia. The ringing denunciations of slavery presented there, which Jefferson had never intended for an American audience, made him a controversial figure, especially within the slave-owning class of Virginia, and the prospective leader of the still quite small group of progressive Southern planters advocating some form of gradual emancipation. It was a prominent public role that ran against the grain of all his instincts for privacy. His deep-seated aversion to controversy actually caused him to exaggerate the expected personal criticism that Notes, or so he feared, would generate, but whether his apprehensions were mostly justified or mostly imagined was beside the point. He was simply not equipped temperamentally to stay at the cutting edge of the anti-slavery movement after he got a dose of the sharp feelings it aroused. Second, the more pessimistic implications of the argument he had made in Notes began to settle in and cause him to realize for the first time that he had no workable answer to the unavoidable question, what happens once the slaves are freed? This was the kind of practical question that Jefferson had demonstrated great ingenuity in avoiding on a host of other major political issues. Indeed, one of the most seductive features of his political thinking in general was its beguiling faith that the future could take care of itself. Slavery, however, proved to be the exception to this larger pattern of calculated obliviousness. For one brief moment in 1789, he seemed to entertain a bold, if somewhat bizarre, scheme whereby emancipated slaves would be intermingled with imported German peasants on 50-acre farms, where both groups could learn proper work habits. But even this short-lived proposal served only to expose the inherent intractability of the post-emancipation world as Jefferson tried to imagine it. His fundamental conviction, one that he never questioned, was that white and black Americans could not live together in harmony. He had already explained why in Notes. Deep-rooted prejudices entertained by the whites, 10,000 recollections by the blacks of the injuries they have sustained, new provocations, the real distinctions that nature has made, and many other circumstances will divide us into parties and produce convulsions which will probably never end, but in the extermination of one or the other race. Here was the single instance with the most singularly significant consequences, when Jefferson was incapable of believing that the dead land of the past could not be swept aside by the liberating forces unleashed by the American Revolution. Blacks and whites were inherently different, and though he was careful to advance the view as a suspicion only, people of African descent were sufficiently inferior to whites in mental aptitude that any emancipation policy permitting racial interaction was a criminal injustice to the freed slaves, as well as a biological travesty against the real distinctions that nature has made. The unavoidable conclusion, then, was that slavery was morally wrong, but racial segregation was morally right. And until a practical solution to the problem of what to do with the freed slaves could be found, it made no sense to press for emancipation. Third, during the latter phase of his French experience, Jefferson became more intensely aware how much his own financial well-being depended upon the monetary value and labor of his slaves. As the depth of his own indebtedness began to sink in, there were three ways to raise large amounts of capital to appease his creditors. He could sell off land, as he did somewhat reluctantly in disposing of holdings in Cumberland and Goochland counties. He could sell slaves outright, or he could rent or lease the labor of his slaves to neighboring planters. He expressed considerable guilt about pursuing the last two options, suggesting it was a betrayal of his paternal obligations to the black members of his extended family. He He gave specific instructions that particular slaves who had been with him for some time not be sold or hired out unless they wished it. But much as he disliked selling his slaves or temporarily transferring control over them to others, he recognized that such a course constituted my only salvation. In short, once he grasped the full measure of his personal economic predicament, the larger question of emancipation appeared in a new and decidedly less favorable light. It was now a matter on which he could not afford to be open-minded, nor, as it turned out, were the exigencies of this debt-induced predicament to change over his lifetime, except to grow worse. The net result of all these influences was a somewhat tortured position on slavery that combined unequivocal condemnation of the institution in the abstract and blatant procrastination whenever specific emancipation schemes were suggested. The Duc de la Rochefoucauldian court captured the essential features and general flavor of Jefferson's slavery stance during his visit to Monticello in June 1796. The generous and enlightened Mr. Jefferson cannot but demonstrate a desire to see these Negroes emancipated, but he sees so many difficulties in their emancipation, even postponed, he adds so many conditions to render it practicable, that it is thus reduced to the impossible. He keeps, for example, the opinion he advanced in his notes that the Negroes of Virginia can only be emancipated all at once, and by exporting to a distance the whole black race. He bases his opinion on the certain danger, if there were nothing else, of seeing blood mixed without means of preventing it. If his position on slavery as a young man merits a salute for its forthright and progressive character, his position as a mature man invites skepticism for its self-serving paralysis and questionable integrity. But latter-day moral judgments are notoriously easy to render from the comfortable perch that hindsight always provides. And such judgments ought not become a substitute for recovering Jefferson's own understanding, no matter how flawed, of what he was doing when he resumed his role as master of Monticello. He saw himself, even more than his slaves, as the victim of history's stubborn refusal to proceed along the path that all enlightened observers regarded as inevitable. In that sense, he and his African-American charges were trapped together in a lingering moment, a historical backwater in which nature's laws would be sorely tested as both sides waited together for the larger story of human liberation to proceed. In this overly extended transitional moment, his primary obligation was to serve as a steward for those temporarily entrusted to his care, and to think of his slaves, as in fact he listed them in his farm book, as members of my family, to be cared for as foster children, until more permanent and geographically distant accommodations could be found. Although the self-serving character of this paternalistic posture might have an offensive odor and fraudulent look to us, it had decided advantages for Jefferson's slaves as well as for Jefferson himself. The major reason why his many returns to Monticello were always greeted by the black population on the mountain as cause for celebration was that it meant the temporary end of control by overseers and the resumption of Jefferson's more benevolent and generous authority. His residence meant fewer whippings, more dependable food and clothing distributions, and the assurance of a more fair-minded arbiter of work schedules. No reliable evidence exists to document any instance in which Jefferson personally flogged a slave or dispensed any physical punishment himself. On rare occasions, and at a last resort, he ordered overseers to use the lash. But his general policy was to sell off troublemakers, effectively banishing them from his extended family as recalcitrant children. He was extremely reluctant to sell slaves against their will. When forced by his creditors to sell 11 slaves in 1792, he ordered that they all be selected from his more remote Bedford plantations, and that the sale itself be carried out in a distant location, acknowledging that he did not like to have my name annexed in the public papers to the sale of property. On the other hand, he tried to respect the wishes of those slaves who asked to be sold, usually to be united with their families. In 1792, for example, he approved the sale of Mary Hemings to Thomas Bell, a local merchant, studiously avoiding mention of the fact that Bell, a white man, was the father of Mary's two youngest children, and the sale, according to her desire, would allow them to live together as common-law husband and wife. Jefferson's own highly developed network of interior defenses also helped sustain his paternalistic self-image by blocking out incongruous evidence, like the Hemings-Bell relationship, or consigning it to some oblivious region of his mind that was cut off from communication with the conscious world, a kind of internal banishment of recalcitrant ideas. Just as he could look squarely at the most atrocious acts of mob violence in revolutionary Paris and see only a momentary excess of human liberty, or could put Philippe Freneau on his payroll as a partisan in the party wars without acknowledging a conflict of interest, or not even admit that he and Madison were orchestrating the political tactics of an opposition party, Jefferson possessed the psychological dexterity to overrule awkward perceptions, including the day-by-day realities of slave life. He was the kind of man who would have been able to take an oath, and if the technology for a lie detector test had been available, to have passed it, certifying that his slaves were more content and better off as members of his extended family than under any other imaginable circumstance. And like a general ensconced at headquarters, he conveyed a clear signal to his overseers in the fields that unpleasant incidents should not filter their way back up the mountain. Partly by geographic accident, partly by his own design, the organization of slave labor at Jefferson's plantations reinforced this shielding mentality in several crucial ways. Recall, first of all, that his cultivated lands were widely distributed, half of them at Bedford, several days' ride away. Until he built his second house at Poplar Forest during his final retirement, Jefferson seldom visited those remote estates. Recall, too, that except for the temporary enthusiasm of 1794-95, he seldom ventured into his fields at Monticello or Shadwell, except at harvest time, leaving daily management of routine farming tasks to overseers. While he kept elaborate records of his entire slave population in his farm book, including the names and ages of all hands, his direct exposure to field laborers was limited. His cryptic notation on the division of slave labor is also revealed in this regard. Children till 10 years of age to serve as nurses. From 10 to 16, the boys make nails, the girls spin. At 16, go into the ground or learn trades. The ominous phrase, go into the ground, accurately conveyed Jefferson's personal contact with that considerable majority of adult slaves who worked his fields. Except as names in his record books, they practically disappeared. When Jefferson did encounter them, it was usually in the context of work on one of his several construction projects, or as apprentices in his nailery. Most of his face-to-face contact with laboring slaves occurred in non-agrarian settings, the nailery, the sawmill, the construction site around the mansion, where he supervised them as workers doing skilled and semi-skilled jobs. Even the nailery, with its overtones of assembly line monotony and Dickensian drudgery, allowed him to think about the work of the slave boys as an apprentice experience, providing them with a marketable trade. In explanation of Jefferson's compulsive tendency to launch so many mechanical and construction projects at Monticello, it is possible that they not only served as outlets for his personal energies, but also allowed him to design a more palatable context for interacting with his slaves as hired employees rather than as chattel. Finally, all the slaves working in the household, and most of those living along Mulberry Row on the mountaintop, were members of two families that had been with Jefferson since the earliest days of his marriage to Martha. They enjoyed a privileged status within the slave hierarchy at Monticello, were given larger food and clothing rations, considerably greater latitude of movement, and even the discretion to choose jobs or reject them on occasion. Great George and his wife, Ursula, referred to as King George, a joke on George III, and Queen Ursula, were slaves in name only and affectionately exercised control over management of the household. When Jefferson asked Thomas Mann Randolph to tell little George, their son, to perform a particular task, Randolph claimed that George, I am sure, would not stoop to my authority. The other and larger slave family were all Hemingses, headed by the matriarch Betty Hemings, whom Jefferson had inherited from his father-in-law, John Wales, along with 10 of her 12 children in 1773. It was an open secret within the slave community at Monticello that the privileged status enjoyed by the Hemings family derived from its mixed blood. Several of Betty's children, perhaps as many as 6, had most probably been fathered by John Wales. In the literal, not just figurative sense of the term, they were part of Jefferson's extended family. All the slaves he eventually freed were Hemingses, including Robert and James in 1794 and 1796, respectively. If what struck the other slaves at Monticello was the quasi-independent character of the Hemings clan, with its blood claim on Jefferson's paternal instincts, what most visitors tended to notice was their color. La Rochefoucauld-Liancourt left this account in 1796. In Virginia, mongrel Negroes are found in greater number than in Carolina and Georgia, and I have even seen, especially at Mr. Jefferson's, slaves who neither in point of color or features showed the least trace of their original descent, but their mothers being slaves, they retain, of consequence, the same condition. Since the members of the Hemings family were the front and center slaves at Monticello, most guests and visitors to the mountaintop experienced the Jeffersonian version of slavery primarily as a less black and less oppressive phenomenon than it actually was. As overseer Edmund Bacon recalled, "There were no Negro and other outhouses around the mansion, as you generally see on other plantations, so the physical arrangement of appearances also disguised the full meaning of the slave experience." In short, Jefferson had so designed his slave community that his most frequent interactions occurred with African Americans who were not treated like full-fledged slaves, and who did not even look like full-blooded Africans because, in fact, they were not. In terms of daily encounters and routinized interactions, his sense of himself as less a slave master than a paternalistic employer and guardian received constant reinforcement. By the same token, if slavery was a doomed institution, whose only practical justification was to preserve the separation of the races, until the day of deliverance arrived at some unspecified time in the future, Jefferson was surrounded by dramatic evidence that it was failing miserably at that task. Miscegenation at Monticello was obviously a flourishing enterprise, much more so than his wheat fields. Several of Betty Hemings's grandchildren looked almost completely white, graphic testimony that whatever had begun with John Wales had certainly not stopped back then. Jefferson's stated aversion to racial mixture had somehow to negotiate its visible examples all around him. In a sense, what he saw only confirmed his deepest fears about an amalgamation of the races, though his code of silence dictated that no mention of the matter be permitted in public. Despite his remarkable powers of avoidance, this is one topic we can be sure he brooded about, even if he never talked about it for the record. The eloquence of his silence provides the best evidence of what Monticello was like as a real place rather than an imagined ideal. If literary allusions afford the best mode of description, we need to dispense with Virgil's pastoral odes and begin to contemplate William Faulkner's fiction. Madisonian Minuet. James Madison probably knew Jefferson as well as or better than anyone else alive, and he recognized from the very start of the sequestration at Monticello that two Jeffersonian truths needed to coexist peacefully for at least the foreseeable future. First, his political mentor and partner regarded his retirement from public life as final. His recovery of some measure of serenity therefore depended on sustaining the illusion that he was done with politics forever. Second, as time passed and his political wounds healed, Jefferson would find it difficult to remain on the sidelines, especially if the cause that had compelled their collaboration appeared.